tuning in. The latest episode of the Big Sky Boneheads podcast. My name is Michael Gray. His name is Scott Hershey. Make sure you subscribe, rate, and view to this thing wherever you found it. It's available on all the various platforms. So if you'd be so kind, that's how we get to do what we do. Super excited about our guest this week. This was the idea we had behind this podcast, was finding people in Montana that are doing cool stuff. That was the only prerequisite. And we've talked to athletes, we've talked to politicians, we've talked to artists, we've talked to a yodeler.
We had a squirrel warrior guy. Don't ever forget that guy. Talk about interesting.
We got the squirrel warriors doing squirrel taxidermy, making them into Vikings and stuff. And now we got it all. This is a cauldron of stuff. Poet, author, photographer, influencer, autism advocate, children's book authors, Tyler Knott Gregson, Sarah Linden, thank you for taking the time coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What did I leave off that list? Because it's a list.
Oh, man. I think you pretty much got it. Yeah.
I just learned the children's book thing 5 seconds ago.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I had to quick scribble that down because I didn't have that.
Yeah, that's another one. There's talks right now. The children's book might be making its way from a book to something you can watch on the TV.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah, that's in the works. We don't know exactly what's going to happen with that, but
it's Hollywood, so who knows?
Yeah. You never know. It's always hurry up and wait. And
I didn't have Hollywood on the list.
Yeah, Hollywood.
And this is interesting for a number of reasons, not just what you do, but also something that you mentioned in one of your videos where you headquarter in Helena, Montana, and you mentioned that in this town, you're never more than one degree of separation away from knowing someone. You're only here because I go to the same gym as your dad.
Yeah.
And your dad works in Major League Baseball.
True.
He showed up one day at the gym wearing a Boston Red Sox logo, and I'm a native Detroiter, so I'm like, boo, piss. You know, I'm looking for holy water. And then I end up talking to him. He's this sweetheart of a guy. His Goose is what he goes by.
Yep.
And we got talking about this podcast. He goes, you got to talk to my son. And I'm like, well, I was expecting the baseball story. He's like, no, he's a poet. Hang on. I feel like you left something out. And then he got talking about your books and Chasers of the Light. And then he's like, oh, and he does the photography too. Oh, and he does this. Oh, and he's got a thing on Instagram. Oh, and they do videos. Hey, what?
Yeah.
And like, where is he? I expected LA.
Sure.
Burbank. So he's like, no, he lives in town.
Yeah.
We'd be better off if we were in LA.
We would be better off. Yeah, it would definitely make travel a lot easier.
Yeah.
And by the way, my dad told me last night, he said he was so excited, and he said, tell him I miss seeing him in the sauna. And I was like, I'm not going to ask.
Careful.
What? That'll be a story for another day.
Yeah, well, that's where, you know, when you're sitting there for 20, 30 minutes a day at the same time every day, I mean, you got to strike up conversation.
Exactly.
It'd be weird if you saw the same people every day and you don't make eye contact like an elevator.
I totally agree.
Never moves.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a sauna etiquette there's deep rules to that. I don't know them.
I will say this, the etiquette erodes the older you get,
sure.
Apparently.
I'm
That's
sure.
What he said.
Yeah, there's a lot of Captain Morgan happening once you get to 60, 70, 80 years old.
That concerns me because my dad's in his 70s, so I wonder which one
know.
He is.
Again, I saw the Red Sox logo, so you know.
Okay,
that
yeah,
was
that's
fine.
Good.
Well, if your dad's in baseball, he spends more time in a locker room than he does
right.
out, even
that's
because
exactly right.
they're also in that a lot.
Yeah, you're not wrong about that.
Start me at the beginning.
Okay.
Poet isn't something they ask you. I want to be a firefighter. I want
sure.
to be president. I want to drive a truck. I want to fly a plane. Like, I'm going to write poetry
yeah.
on recycled typewriters.
That's, yeah. I've been writing poetry since I was probably 12, I think. We started with the cowboy poetry here in town. My teacher's name was Miss Heffelfinger. The crazy thing is that year I had Heffelfinger and Arm Brewster as my teachers, and I just thought it was like straight out of Roald Dahl.
It sounds made
it's
up.
It's like from Matilda.
It's Dr. Seuss.
It really is. And so, but I don't know, we had to do this cowboy poetry unit, and with my autism, I didn't know at the time that I was autistic. I just knew that the way that I thought, nobody else thought like, and I always got in a lot of trouble for it. And especially when there's all these rules and things that you're supposed to do and a special way you're supposed to do it. And that just never worked for me. And so when the poetry unit happened, all of a sudden it was this light bulb went off and I was thinking, wait, I can write however I want and I can say whatever I need and I can clear out the cobwebs and get it out somewhere productive. And it just felt like liberation. And so I fell in love with writing poetry really quickly then. And then it became the thing that just got me through all the rest of school. I would, everyone else would be taking notes and writing things down, and I would just be writing poetry forever. And I still was playing baseball at the time. I played baseball right up until basically I had to decide if I wanted to play baseball or give it up. And I gave it up. And I remember at the time wondering how my dad was going to feel about that and how he was going to take it. And he was amazing. And he was just like, no, do what you need to do to be happy. And if that's not your path, that's not your path. And I think especially because he saw how really rigorous and hard of a lifestyle that it is. He's gone a lot and he always has been. He just left again. And so I think it made sense to him that that probably didn't fit. You know, I was never much of a team sports player.
Right.
But yeah, that's where it all started. It was just more out of need than anything else. It was a necessity thing. Like if I wasn't writing, I didn't feel good. And so that's always what it's been. And that's where it started.
That's a form of expression that I think when people now think about poetry, they think of stuff that's, if not hundreds of years old, at least decades old. It doesn't seem like a current form of art anymore. And that's, you know, I know completely that that is definitely not the case, but I hate to use the word archaic.
No, you're right.
It's never going to be archaic. It's always going to be expressed in one form or another.
Sure.
There's still an audience. There's still a market out there for poetry. And from what you've done, and I've seen some of your work, and I've done different forms of art, finding something different, finding something that people hook onto and latch onto. You know, if you're doing poetry for yourself, that's the first important part. The second thing is if you're going to do anything with it outside of just yourself, you have to find something that's your own.
Yeah.
You've done that so incredibly in a unique way, which is important. And tell us a little bit about the process, about how you ended up doing old typewriters on some of these different types of paper you do.
Yeah, you're right. To be honest, when I first started doing this, I never thought that there was a market for it. It was just a way for me. I mean, I'd been doing it, like I said, since I was 12. And I think the typewriter series started...
12 years ago.
Yeah,
right?
12 years ago. So, I mean, I've been doing it. I'll be 43 this year. So, you know, a long, long time ago, I started writing poetry, and I never thought there was a market for it. Because, like you said, to me, it was just always, I always had a bone to pick with poetry and the way that it, the world that it created. And I always thought that there was like a very sharp line that was drawn. And it was, in order to be poetry, it has to be really obscure and opaque and hard to understand. It has to use really elevated language. And for me, that took me out of it because I didn't understand why it was just necessarily poetic to say something that was really confusing. And I thought it would be a lot harder. Yeah. I mean, there's so many where you're like, oh, I wonder what that guy was saying there. I wonder what that means. And, you know, I wonder if you were alive today, if you were to say, what did that really mean? He'd probably be like, oh, no, I literally saw a bird fly across the sky.
Right.
It was a bird. That was it. It didn't mean anything about death or mortality or anything. And so that was always what I wanted to try with my words was, I found it to be much more of a challenge to say a really complex thing in a really simple way that people could actually relate to. And that's where that all came from. And the whole old typewriter thing, I literally was in Golden Girls Antiques here, and there was an old 1927 Remington Rand 17 giant beast of a typewriter. And I had just found an old book. I had always typed my poems just on broken book pages so I didn't have to buy paper from, you know, I don't like just shiny white paper. And so I liked the look of the typewriter, and I was like, there's no way that the ink ribbon is going to work on this. So I just fed in the title page. And while I was standing there, I just typed it out all in one go and no edits. I couldn't backspace. I couldn't correct. I couldn't change, move lines around or anything. And that's where it just like really clicked in was, this is how I'm supposed to write. And so to this day, I don't edit anything I write, which I never know if there's some of it's bad, some of it's good. I have no idea. It's just whatever comes out in that instant, that's how it has to stay. And the typewriter makes that. You can't you can't go back on what you're saying.
And to give a description to somebody who hasn't seen it, it's also done on different types of paper, which aren't just old book pages. They are. I saw those pages with old imagery, with some sort of imagery, and your words fit around them. Not only they fit around them verbally, they fit around them the way that you type them on the paper. You've got paper with burn marks on it. You've got, and it turns into a frameable work of art, and then the poem on it is also art. I mean, it's just, to me, looking at it was just so unique, and it strikes you. So, I mean, that imagination to come up with that, like I said, it seems so simple standing in the thrift store and you do it, and you're like, that looks cool.
Yeah.
But you've just taken it to the next level.
Well, thank you. I mean, I feel like that's overly generous. I feel that makes it feel like there was like an actual thought process behind it. To be totally honest, it was literally just, I don't want to do it on white paper and I don't want to go buy anything. And so I would use receipts or napkins, or we always steal the notepads from hotels whenever we stay anywhere. And it was literally just, I would grab whatever I could find. And then there were some papers, like you said, like old maps and stuff, where I definitely, the poem itself felt like the paper and felt like what was visual on there. And so I would try to fit it around there just out of necessity. But I think that is the funniest thing, is just like I was saying about the guy who wrote the poem about the bird. It literally just was born out of, I have all these things to say, I just need free paper to type it on, I'm just going to make it on here. And the only reason I even ever shared them that way was, she had the idea, Sarah had the idea, you should put these on Instagram. And this was 12 years ago. And at that time, Instagram was literally only photos.
It was just pictures.
Just pictures. And it was, you know, they had those 10 or 12 really terrible filters. And so it would just be like these orange washed out photos of someone's cat and, you know, their coffee that morning. Mm-hmm. There wasn't any poetry on there. And she said, you should just share those. And I remember I just told her, no one's going to care about this. This is, it's a photo place. No one's going to care. And I started it, and really quickly, a lot of people started responding and following and sharing, and then some celebrities shared it. And we were just joking just last night. Everything that we have done, everywhere we have gone, everyone we have met, all of the strange, strange things that we've done, all came out of that decision to share poetry on Instagram. Everything was born from that, literally. And it's...
You're welcome.
I know.
I was going to say.
Yeah, she's the brains behind the whole operation.
You seem too humble to go, I'm going to take this to the next level. And Sarah, you go ahead and brag about how you pushed him for that. And also name drop some celebrities who are sharing this on Instagram.
It's weird. I mean, we have a memory wall in our house where all of our memories from, I mean, hotel keys to receipts from places to whatever. And we were just standing there last night looking at it and laughing, when we were just saying, man, if you would have told me 12 years ago that sharing some poetry on Instagram would have given birth to this life, I never would have believed you.
Well, and what kind of responsibility is that? Because, you know, it occurs to me in looking at all your stuff, you've created a community, or at least curated one that was kind of in the ether anyway. Yeah. And, you know, you kind of corralled them. That's, I mean, it sounds great. Fame sounds great. Right up until you're famous. And then, you know, what is that like? That responsibility of having all of these people that are looking to you because they've been inspired, sure, or they've been comforted, or they've found some bond or connection in some way with something that for you, I know you're downplaying it with the fusion of the technology with your kind of your vision for this thing. But it occurred, you know, while I'm listening, you're like, oh, no, the typewriter is the perfect mechanism for that kind of thought. Like, I want to go simple. I want this out of my head. I want it on the paper. There, we're done. I can walk away. What about that?
I think that is a good word. Responsibility is a good word. That's something that I don't think Sarah or I saw coming. It really is a strange thing. I mean, so we're doing this thing today where we're selling off some of the originals. We're giving people a chance to own the actual original papers, because we literally have over 3,000 poems sitting in binders in our house. And people love them so much that we thought, okay, well, one, it would be nice to have a little extra money during the slow point when we're not shooting weddings. But then two, I've always thought of the poems kind of like the threads on the bottom of like a Buddhist prayer flag. They're supposed to fly out and find new people and reach people at different stages of their life and stuff. And so to give people a chance to own those. But what's been interesting is all the responsibility comes where people write in and they tell you, you have no idea how many times like your poetry has saved my life. And when you hear that, and she's been instrumental in that too, because we hear that, it's easy to just hear that online and respond in kind and say, that's amazing. If you ever need anything, let me know.
Although I don't think that's easy. The way you respond to every single person. I mean, you respond to hundreds, thousands of people.
Yeah.
And you actually take the time to do that. And I don't think many people would. So yeah, I'm just going to brag.
No, most yeah. people wouldn't.
No.
Most people wouldn't even consider it.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I think because I know that a lot of the people who are finding, like a lot of the poems came from a really, especially in the typewriter series, came from a really hard time where I was feeling very low and very broken and like it was really hard to find the light. And that's why our company is called Chasers of the Light. And so I think I feel that onus where it's a lot of the people who are reaching out are doing so because they might be in that same place. And so I feel if they're taking the time to reach out to me because they're feeling that way, the least I can do is make sure that they're okay. And yeah, I guess maybe a lot of people probably wouldn't do that, but I just feel like there's like a higher need for that when it is, that's the reason why people are reaching out. But the community that's been born from it, it's absolutely amazing. It's one of our favorite things. We've taught a few Life Reboot courses online, and multiple people in those have now fallen in love, gotten engaged just from our online course. I mean, it's really insane. And then I have this newsletter I write every week, and there's a community that is born out of that. And I mean, there's like 500 people in that one, and everybody supports each other, and it really has had this trickle down effect. And I think that's been one of the coolest things out of all of this, is just to see, I mean, it's like almost like one of those weird hokey pay it forward things, to see that happen in real time and play out in real life and see that. I mean, was it Gandhi that said you must be the change you want to see in the world? To see that that's a real thing that happens. If you demonstrate how to do that to people, people will do that too. And then they'll follow up, and then it happens. It's a real thing, and it's cool.
No, it's the fact that you found a way to use the internet for good.
Yeah,
because I'm at the point now where I'm like, I open my phone like somebody who's looking through a war journal.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, oh, God, yeah. What's this? What's
yeah?
What happened today?
Yes.
Gross. So that alone,
yeah,
is something special that you can create, and again, curate that.
Yeah. And don't let her fool you at all. Of like, we've done multiple book tours and stuff, and some of them have been for poetry, others have been for the kids' book. But what's amazing is she can brag about me all she wants, but I'm going to brag about her. Every time we do these, as much as people stand in line and wait to ask me questions, I would say seriously, 70% of them are literally there because of her, because they are so drawn to, I always call it a grace, the grace in her, that they all want a minute of her time too. And there's been so many times where, you know, at the poetry signings, people like come up and they're tearful or they're having a hard time formulating their thoughts. And every single one of them, Sarah will sit with and hold their hand and talk to and calm them down. And everybody turns to her just as much as they turn to me. And I think it's because they know that everything I do came from her, if that makes sense. Like, she was the genesis of everything, like all the words, all the everything. She was the start of it all. And I think everybody feels that. And when I don't know, if there's somebody writing 3,000 poems and they're basically all about or inspired by one person, I think everybody really quickly feels that person, and they understand, and then they meet her and they're like, okay, I get it.
You're the muse.
She's the muse.
Absolutely.
It's Valentine's Day. Way to go.
But it is. I mean, I don't know. People feel that from you immediately. And so I don't think the community would be a quarter of what it is in members or in impact if it wasn't for you. And that's just the truth.
There's a difference between, in all the art forms, being the person who creates it and having all of the skills needed to reach any level of success or any level of notoriety at all. You need those things. And usually the artist doesn't have those. The balance is a team. And I'm sure that there's aspects that we're going to get into outside of just the poetry, because you guys have so many irons in the fire, that you're more of the face of it, Sarah. And what are some of those those things that you do, like, because obviously, here's what I, when I was looking at this morning, I thought, these people don't nap much. They don't have a lot of spare time. We have to take some of the time that they could be doing other things, because there's so many kind of tentacles of what you guys are doing. And you mentioned one of them kind of being the coaching part of that. And my first thought is, you know, and sometimes when people hear about people coaching in life, like, you're very humble people. I can tell you're just, you know, normal every people that are sitting here with us. But the first people think, well, why should they be able to tell me what I should do with my life?
Exactly.
But that's not really what you're doing. You're just sharing things you've learned, which is any teaching.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, any teaching. If you're talking to a guy who's teaching you carpentry, he's just sharing what he learned. That's all you guys are doing. So tell us a little bit about that, how you kind of got to that that point of going out and talking to other people about that.
Yeah, I think it was more people kept asking us questions. It started about our relationship, like how do you two navigate working together? We're literally together like 23 hours a day.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about that.
Yeah, we are.
All the time.
The only reason my wife and I have been married for 18 years is because we work across town.
Yeah.
All day, every day would no bueno.
Yeah, it, for some reason, it works really well for us. And I think that's why the questions started coming, because people were like, "What? How do you make this work?" And a lot of the times it's like, well, I don't know. We just work well together. I think that if I were to say what my job would be, it would mostly be just like steering the ship a little bit and taking off some of the things that I'm like, okay, well, let's just focus on one thing right now, because his brain is doing 47 things. I have my degree in early childhood special education with a focus in autism. And so that also helps with our navigating the world, I think. And so when we first started teaching the courses, it was out of the questions that we kept getting from people. And it was a lot of people who were struggling with mental health issues and loneliness and things that we... Like you said, we have lived. Mm-hmm. We've been through those things. And I know a lot of people have, but we just felt this pull to those people. And we just wanted to get deeper and help them as much as we could. And so that's kind of just where that class came from.
Yeah. And I think your background in that too is really instrumental, because I mean, we've done a lot of charity work here in town with the Head Start program and a lot of the special needs programs, where for years, every Christmas, we would do photos and stuff. And I think the thing that if you were to take one aspect of every single amazing teacher that works with those kids, there's an element of patience there that you either have and you know it, or you just don't have. And she has that in spades. And I think that with me especially helps, but then also there's such a patience with her where people who are slow to open or slow to really explain what they're feeling or how they're feeling it, I'm always just like, all right, well, let's just fix this. I know, let's just get into this and let's fix it. And that doesn't work a lot of the times. And she is so good at just letting it blossom on its own and giving it the space to breathe. And I think that's something that she brings that I definitely do not have.
Where does the, and forgive my ignorance here, because I've heard from a couple of people, I was just listening to a podcast this morning, and it was Holly Madison, the Playmate, was talking about being a late diagnosed on the spectrum. It was later in life she figured it out. And for her, it was an aha.
Were you listening to that for the autism aspect of this to learn?
The articles?
Or were you just listening to a Playmate podcast?
Oddly enough, she's in her 40s now. She was on Jericho's podcast as a Playmate talking to a wrestler about a podcast she does, and it came up, and it was one of those things that, again, for her it was like, oh. Now, was there any of that for you? Or
oh yeah,
like when was the diagnosis, how did that come in? It was her Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'd had all through my life, I had had teachers and counselors, and everybody was suggesting that there was something wrong. That's how it was always framed to me. Was there something wrong?
Yeah, what's wrong with you?
Exactly.
Why can't you do this like everybody else does?
Exactly. Yep. And sure. I would get on my report cards. They would always say something like, he excels in the scholastic part of school, but he talks way too much. He doesn't take my direction. He doesn't listen to rules. He randomly walks out of class, all these things. And for a long time, it was just, oh, he's just a problem kid. He's the class clown. I was the only kid that got a vote for class clown senior year of high school. I mean, I was always in trouble, always. And so, and then I went to college and some of my professors were like, have you ever thought, you know, have you ever been screened for, you know, maybe being on the autism spectrum? And I would just be like, oh no, I don't know. And they're like, oh, okay, well, you know, maybe one day you should look into that. And I just always thought, well, no, my brain just works different. And then I met Sarah and we started working together and spending time together. And one day she sat down and she said, no, for real, have you ever done a screener? And I said, no, I haven't done a screener. And she said, well, I have one. And it's, I can't remember the exact of it. But she's like, but it's one that we use for school. Why don't you do it? I'll do it too as a baseline and we'll just compare. And I feel like the one that she gave me was on a weighted scale, 0 to 40 or something. And the closer to 40 you scored, the more likely it was that you were somewhere on the spectrum. And so she took it first and I think she got 6. And I was like, oh, well, I'm going to get like a 12 or a 13. And I got a 39. And that was the first moment where it was,
all the needles are in the red.
Yeah. I mean, it was literally like Spinal Tap, like, oh, this goes to 11. And I remember right then she just said, yeah. And so that was even still before I got the clinical diagnosis. But at that time, then, of course, my brain immediately wanted to just do all the research. And so I just started reading about it. And it was a series of dominoes of aha moments where, Oh, wait. And I think that was such a revelation because all of a sudden it was, no, you're not broken. You're just different. It just, your brain works right on a completely different way than other people's.
And it's so cool.
Yeah. And I think that was the first time, yeah, that I ever felt like this might be kind of a superpower. I mean, there's certainly times where it's the opposite. There are a lot of times where it is so hard. I mean, it really is. And my brain's always just processing everything all at the same time. And that can be a lot. And it really is a lot. But then there's other times where it absolutely is a superpower. I mean, it really is.
But without that diagnosis, without being aware, it can be very dangerous.
I definitely think so.
Just listening to what you're talking about reminds me of my son. And they can be real dangerous, trust me. And I know that aspect and that he was never diagnosed, but there's certain aspects of what you're talking about that immediately struck a nerve, even in kind of the, without all the details, just the vagueness that we've covered so far. It just kind of hit me like,
for sure.
And so, yeah, I can understand that it's probably a little shocking. But also, I'll bet you all your friends and relatives went, yeah, that makes perfect sense. I have a friend who went to the Army, and he said, well, first of all, they diagnosed me with a pretty high-level ADHD, and he goes, I had no idea. And I was like, seriously? Right. I've known this guy my whole life. I'm like, are you serious?
Yeah.
He goes, yeah, they put me on some medication. They helped me out with some things. He goes, made perfect sense. I'm like, Mike, you're the only one that didn't know then, because we all knew.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was every person in my life. Same thing. Everyone was like, well, I guess, although my parents still, I think their generation comes from a more, like, my dad's motto when we were kids was just rub some dirt on it. So if anything, like physically, if you fell and got hurt when we were kids, he'd be like, nope, grab some dirt and rub on it. Now you're in control of how it hurts. Like it's just rub some dirt on it, get over it, you're going to be fine. And I think that there was an element, he got that from his dad, who was a railroad man and he was in the military. And I think that there was definitely this element of, I don't know if that's real, do you know? And I think that that's generationally, she's seen it with a lot of the parents of the kids that she's taught. There's just this thing where it's like, no, there's nothing wrong with you. And I think there's almost like a stigma that comes with admitting that your brain works different. And for me, it's something I'm extremely proud of. And I would never relegate or, you know, reduce down to being something else. It's, no, I'm autistic. That's what it is. And I do still think, though, that there is a stigma associated. And so it's, everyone else in my life was immediately like, oh, everybody knew that. Yeah, of course we knew that. And for them, I think my parents are, my dad, not as much. My mom still, though, is sometimes she's just like, I don't know. Maybe you're not. And I'm just like, maybe not. But it doesn't matter to me. But like you said, there is a danger in going through your whole life just feeling broken when it's not, there's nothing broken. It's just different. It's just like running a different operating system. And yeah. So if anyone is listening and you're wondering, it's absolutely worth finding out and getting some answers, because it really does it clears the driveway and lets you, you know, smooth sail.
I think part of the danger is your brain works differently, mm-hmm. and you're looking at everyone else and you're going, why are they, if your brain is like everyone else's, if everybody is dealing with the same things you're dealing with and looking around and going, why do they handle it so well?
Yeah.
And I'm struggling with this.
Yep.
And I think that's where understanding that there's a difference. Okay.
Yeah.
Now I can deal with it. Now I can listen and understand that not everyone, all these people out there just going about it like this isn't bothering them, like it's not a thing for them, but yeah. it is for me. So now I can learn about it.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. It takes away the element of choice. I think that there's a propensity to just be like, oh, I can just choose to be better. I just need to work harder at this. I just need to try harder and then it'll be fine. And then once you realize that it has nothing to do with that, and it's just, I mean, like it's, I always say that it's like all of my senses are turned up beyond the beyond. And so, you know, while a neurotypical person might be sitting here and thinking about what their voice sounds like or that it's snowing outside, mine at the same time is processing the temperature in the room, the way the table feels under my hand, the way, like how I have to move the headphones slightly off my ear so it doesn't feel like I'm in a helmet. I mean, all of these things all at the exact same time. And I don't need to, there's nothing wrong with that, but I need to understand that it's not that I'm just like, Tyler, focus harder on the task at hand. It's not about that. It's just that I'm getting more stimulus from more things all at the same time.
Yeah, and you can't bootstrap your way out of that.
No, you can't.
And I know this is more a question for you, Sarah, because I know it's been, I'm a parent, about to be 13, about to be 16 at home, and I'm only a little older than you at a time, you know, coming up through the 80s when everything was assimilation. Yeah. Like just, why can't you do this way? Going through the process of raising kids has made me aware of a number of things. And all of a sudden you get into some of the diagnoses and other things like, have you talked to a person? Oh, I'd really rather this remain undiagnosed. You know, you do trauma response tests and other things because, you know, you become aware of it on a different level with kids.
Yep.
What about when it's an adult? And, you know, how much of that goes into this relationship and that awareness for you?
I mean, I think I just knew the moment I met him. it took a bit, because my, like I said, my focus was in autism in college, and I always have been drawn to kids with autism and I guess adults also.
Sure.
But I just think that they have such superpowers, and I think that the world is, it's not them that is broken. It's our world for sure. And it's the way that we move through the world and just, like you said, we'll just figure it out. You got to just go.
Right.
And I think especially with an adult who hasn't been diagnosed, they have even more roadblocks up. Because as a kid, like you said, our parents generally will help their children get through things, maybe even a little bit too much sometimes, mm-hmm. the snowplow parenting and stuff. But as an adult, that's gone. And so they're on their own. And so these adults who have not been diagnosed, I think they have an even harder time. And it's, there's even more of a stigma because of, you know, our age, and it just wasn't, autism wasn't a thing when we were kids.
Right.
It was, but it wasn't something we talked about.
For so many people my age, the first experience most of us had with autism was Rain Man.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that to this day, still makes an impression on me.
Right.
I'm like, okay.
Oh, you're not sitting in a corner rocking back and forth. You're fine. You know,
right.
Like if that's not it.
He can make a sentence.
Yeah,
exactly.
And you can look at me in the eyes.
Right.
That's, yeah. You know, and so I think they have such a harder time because they have to be the ones, adults have to be the ones to say, actually, I feel like something is different and I would like to go and have it checked out or, you know, talk to somebody about it. And when that's left until they're adults, it's just a lot harder. And so I think I was so proud that he was willing to go because that was something that I knew in my heart that if he got the diagnosis that I knew he had, it would make him feel better and more understood, and it would help me too, because even though I knew it was nice for him to know, and we could go forward in that together.
For sure.
Yeah.
And so the next step, I think, past that is to get to where you're at now is I imagine that some of these things that are different about you are good for what you're doing now, doing poetry, doing, you know, having stuff to focus your energy and then that brain into, with all of these different varieties of things. Also, again, also positive that you have more than one. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably is exactly where you need to be. And so that feeling of like the outlet of where do I go with this? Now, this is where the energy goes. This is where these thoughts go.
Yeah.
Is like you've just got to feel like that I found the right thing.
Absolutely. I was just talking to my brother-in-law last night about that. He just got a new job and it's, I'm so proud of him. He's going to be making so much money and he just deserves it because he worked so hard. And as a joke, right at the end, I just said, hey, will you just teach me how to not be so poor? And he laughed and he said such an insightful and beautiful thing. He just said, there is such a richness into not having to go into an office. And he said, you have no idea how rich you are that you get to do what you're doing and the way you do it. And, you know, as I was, of course, I was, well, yeah, but that doesn't pay my health insurance.
Right. Yeah. So, tell that to the power
company. I still like a jet ski.
Exactly. But he was so right in that we feel so lucky. And that's what I feel so lucky to have her, because there was a really long period of my life where, because I was undiagnosed and I didn't really understand what was going on with me, my solution for that at the time, I just convinced myself that I don't need to travel. I don't need to see the world. I'm fine staying in my house. It's okay. And I kind of just, in a lot of ways, I was super young and I just kind of gave up and I convinced myself that I was content with the way things were. And then I met Sarah and immediately she was like, oh no, you need to see the world and the world needs to see you and you need to let people in and you need to go see things. There's things to go do. And at the beginning, I remember just being like, yeah, but that's just too hard. Some people just aren't made for that life.
And it's goddamn terrifying.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. The idea that, no, the world needs to see me. No.
Yeah.
No, what, exactly. Why would I do that?
Exactly. Uh-huh. And she just kept saying, she's like, no, you owe this to yourself and you owe it to them and you owe it to me. Like, let's try. Let's just try. What's the worst that can happen? And I remember at one point I was like, well, yeah, what if I like poop my pants or something?
Right. Like I could go pretty far down the road of the worst that could happen.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And she was like, well, then you poop your pants and we get you new pants. And I was like, oh, okay, that's not that bad. And so I remember the very first time we traveled together, I was terrified the whole time. And then I did it and it started getting easier and easier. And then it has now become this part of us that I can't imagine my life without. And it took that reminder that sometimes the scariest thing you can think of isn't even scary at all. It's just that you blow it up in your mind. And now I look back and, like you said, the weird way that my brain works and sees the world and crafts things out of things, it literally has opened these doors where we get to wander the world and we get to meet strange people and strange places and do the weirdest things that you just, it's just so weird. I mean, we were talking to one of Henry's friends the other day and like Bella Hadid and Justin Bieber's wife came up and Elliot was sitting across the room and I was like, Elliot, did I ever tell you about the time I modeled with Bella Hadid and Hailey Bieber? And he just laughed. He's like, oh yeah, okay. And then he goes, wait, are you being serious? And I was like, no, yeah. And he goes, wait, is there a photo? And I was like, yeah. And I Googled it and you can Google it. And I brought it up. He's like, wait, that's Bella Hadid and that's Hailey Bieber. And I was like, yeah, I wasn't kidding. He's like, you're so weird. The life that you've lived. And it is all, I think it literally all comes from that weird way that a brain can work, and then having this person, like she said, that can steer it and then give grace to it and then be patient with it. And I mean, everything kind of came from that.
Well, it's all kind of circular in the talking about getting over your fears of all the fears. Being an artist of any kind, whether it be a songwriter, a painter, kind of bearing your soul is the way it's done. I mean, the way it's done well, it's very hard to do. That's talk about the biggest fear of anybody. You know, there's part of the being a human is that one of the biggest fears is of all people is speaking in public. And all that is just putting yourself out there. The reason is you're exposed, everybody's attention's on you. If everybody's attention is on you and the things that have hit you the most emotionally, the things that have affected you, the hardest things, the deepest thoughts, those are what makes an artist great. And it's also literally that's your inner self. Really very hard to do. So traveling's hard, but that's even harder. And like I said, that brings you right back to poetry. Overcoming your fears, doing it well, putting it out there, writing it down is one thing. That's the first step. That's hard to do. Putting it in front of somebody else, no matter who it is the second step. And then putting it out there for anybody who wants to read it. That's really tough.
The weird thing is, and that's kind of why I said that I think autism is a superpower. The one thing that is probably, it might be unique to my autistic experience, but I can't be embarrassed. I really can't. And this sounds super weird to say this, but I literally feel like I was born without an ego. And I tell people that and everyone laughs and I'm like, oh yeah, of course, that sounds real. But it really is. So the weirdest thing is public speaking, which is something that terrifies most people, I don't care at all about. And I remember my very first book signing, it was in New York City. It was at the Barnes & Noble on the Upper East Side. And I remember sitting in the little green room, and I'd never done this before. I'd never had anything like this. And I remember asking, I had an agent, and I said, well, did anybody come? And she kind of, her eyes got big, and Sarah's eyes got big because they had looked out, and they're both like, oh yeah, the people came. And I just remember like, well, that's weird. That's weird that people showed up for this. And I remember they opened the door and there was like 600 people sitting in this auditorium thing in New York City. And I just had to go and sit up on stage holding a microphone with my publisher at the time. And the weirdest thing was I was more worried about where to put the microphone than I was about anything else. And so like, if you were to watch it, I was just fumbling with the microphone the whole time, but I didn't care at all that there were 600 people. And all of my book signings that are the same way, I just go and I sit by myself up in front of a bunch of people. And I just tell people they can ask me anything they want, that nothing's off limits. And that's never bothered me. And I think that all comes from that idea that I've never been embarrassed in my whole life. I've never felt... And I think I really do think it's because I don't feel that ego. I don't know what that feels like. And so when I see people get embarrassed about things like that, I'm just like, why do you care? Why do you care what that guy thinks or that? It's okay. You just do your thing. And so that is a weird thing that I feel like the autism has given me as a superpower. It's just almost like an invincibility cloak for any of that.
Well, I feel like I'm doing a service then, bringing up the bell curve for everybody else, because the shame, anxiety stuff. Oh, I got that down.
Oh, me too.
Yeah,
no, me
too. I take that with me.
I'm closer to you.
Okay, I like it.
100%.
We're divided by the plexiglass. Right.
And in our radio job, I've had to do embarrassing things. I'm like, all right, I'll go do that. Yeah. It doesn't bother me. Right. And people are like, oh my God, some of the stuff you've done. And I'm like, oh, it doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
In front of a crowd in my underwear, I don't care. And I've literally done that.
That's
more
amazing.
Than once. And it just doesn't register with me. So. I just find that that I was really kind of identifying with that because that seems normal.
That's awesome.
And like, well,
I said,
you're the artist. I got a degree in engineering.
See, okay. And he finds it weird that I'm an artist. I've done poetry. I've never really done anything deep, anything that he might like, any stuff we were just talking about. I used to do a segment called Hershey's Bad Poetry when I was on a radio show in Missoula.
Okay.
And we would take three suggestions for a topic, and... I would pick one, and then I would write in the course of two songs, I would write an entire poem about it.
That's amazing.
And it was usually long. It was usually a full sheet of paper. I would just scribble madly.
Yeah.
And I did poetry from anything from concerts to meter maids.
That's amazing.
I did one about the meter maids in Missoula that people requested copies of.
Really?
And I did it in 6 minutes.
That's
so
amazing.
So we did another one we did one in Great Falls where my morning show partner was a guitar player and a singer. And we did one where during the course of 1 hour, we would create a song and he would do the music and I'd do the lyrics. And I would, they'd give us a subject and I would write a song as quickly as I could scribble it out, just handing him sheets of paper. And he'd be over there trying to do, to work out a tune to it. So I see a lot of similarity. Oddly enough, I would have never thought you and I would be a little bit similar at all. And yet the more you're talking about kind of the way your brain works and stuff, and I have a son.
Do you have one of those tests with you?
Yeah, exactly.
I know. Get it.
Yeah, I have a son who unfortunately passed away, and oh. I see so many similarities. It's just this is really clicking. So
yeah.
You know, the educational process about learning this stuff, who knows where it's going to hit you and somebody you know.
Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, that's what we were talking about this morning. If you just say yes to a lot of things, you just have no idea what connections are going to be made, what stories are going to come from it, and it's all part of it.
And I think that was the push for sharing the poetry online. Initially, I was like, sorry, but it's not about you. Like, people need to see this. They need to read this. I know they'll connect with it because the words that you're writing are real pain that you're going through, or things that you're struggling with that I know is not only yours. I know that other people share it. And so I think that was why I pushed him so hard to travel and to meet people and to share his poetry. And
yeah, I even feel like there's bleed over into our photography too, because I've always said that whatever we can't say with poetry, we say with photography, and whatever we can't photograph, we say with poetry. The two kind of finish each other off. And I've noticed even in the weddings that we do and the people that we photograph and stuff, there's always that element. Mm-hmm. Like, there's always that same element of people that have been through what we've been through or who feel like we feel, they're drawn to us. And so it's really funny because we might not get like the $40,000 Bozeman weddings, you know, where it's super fancy and they spent however much $1,000 on this and that and this. We don't get a lot of those weddings. All of the weddings we get are people who have a story that resonates with us and that feels that way. And it's been really cool even with that to see what us teaming up and deciding to do that as a job together, it's brought us to those same people. And it's really interesting that both aspects of the poetry and the photography, it really is like a Venn diagram. Like, in the middle of both of those worlds, there is a similar community on both sides. And it's been really cool to see that crossover.
Yeah, we haven't shot a whole lot of weddings that are just like everything is sunshine and roses. No. And their whole relationship has been easy and everyone's supportive. Most of the weddings we shoot are, you know, they've been through some
struggled
stuff, so. Yeah.
Well, and I'm glad you gave me the perfect segue, because I try not to engage in too many floral platitudes. And my mom was a bit of a mystic, and I always used to roll my eyes like, okay, nope, read me my horoscope again, Mom. But you guys have a very distinct, powerful energy about you. And it occurs to me, like, talking to you now, the photographs make sense. Your photography makes sense, having met you, because you guys bring this, I gotta believe, wherever you go. And it's reflected in the visuals. Is that an outlet for you as well?
Yeah, I've been doing photography since high school. So that was my outlet.
Okay.
My dad majored in photography, and so I always was interested in it. And I was the yearbook photographer and that kind of thing. And then I started doing, mine has always been the people connection. Like, that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in like relationships and people and those little moments of intimacy in the photos. And Tyler's usually like, whoa, did you see that bird? And we're at a wedding and I'm like, hey, look this way. This is where the wedding is. And he captures the most beautiful photos of the couples as well. But it's always been like when we travel and it's photos for fun, I always want to take photos of the people, and he does the landscapes and the animals.
Mostly the animals. Yeah.
But it represents, because, you know, talking to you two and seeing the kind of energy that you share, it shows up in those photos.
Oh, that's amazing.
Is that something you're looking to expand? You know, are you guys at a threshold? It sounds like you got a lot going on.
No.
So I don't know how much room for that kind of thing there would even be.
You know, it's funny because we were talking about this the other day. it's been 12 years of travel for us. I mean, last year alone, we were calculating this up for my mom the other day, like between March and October, I think we found out we flew like 75,000 miles and we drove 9,000 miles. And so we're tired a lot of the times. I mean, I think we flew over the Atlantic four different times between March and October last year. And then in between those, we were in, I mean, all over the United
States.
Where
are you going? Yeah. What's on the other side of the Atlantic? Where were you headed?
We went to Ireland twice, England, Wales, back, and then back to Ireland, and then back. It was nuts. And it's been like
amazing.
But it is, we're getting older and it just gets harder, especially like with Helena losing our Minneapolis flight. That's just killed us, because that was like every Thursday we were on the Minneapolis flight. Yep. And now it's like you have to go over to Bozeman and then either stay the night before. But we are really we are passionate about photography. And so for the first time, we're trying to work more here, because her kids only have like 2 and 3 years left of high school, and we're missing a lot of things being on the road so much. And so we are really trying to work more here. But the hurdle we've ran into there is nobody thinks that we live here or work here anymore. And we're so out of touch that we don't, like, if we get 15 weddings in a year, maybe one of them is in Helena. Maybe. And we're like, man, what is going on here? Like, this should be easier to find work in Helena. But we have no idea. We have no idea what we're doing wrong. But it is something that we're actively trying. We're trying to stay home more and stay local a lot more often.
I know there's folks listening who are like, there's a loose end hanging out here. All right, we covered, you are a poet. We covered the autism spectrum. We've covered photography. There's a children's book you mentioned a long time ago with possible TV. How does that even come about? Is that... It seems like a different area.
That's
got to be one of those things, because we've talked to people like this. Like, I've got an idea, and then you guys take the idea all the way to fruition. Like, some people go, I got an idea, I'm going to write a children's book. And the next morning you wake up and you forget that ever happened, or that was kind of silly. But you've taken it all the way. So how did that come about, and where are you going with that?
So it came about because my kids were being brats at Christmas time, really. and I was noticing, like, on the internet, how you mentioned, like, oh God, this is gross. That's what I was noticing. I was noticing people's Advent, like, Elf on the Shelf. It was mostly Elf on the Shelf stuff was getting, like, more and more ridiculous. And the final straw was someone gave their kid on, like, December 12th a Disney cruise. And I was like, ugh, that is so gross.
What are we doing?
Like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's a Werther's.
Yes.
Exactly.
It's basically the same thing,
yes.
Right?
Yes. And so I was like, all right, that's it. We got to do something better. And so I made up this plan that there was this team of North Pole ninja elves that would deliver missions to my kids every day in December. And so every morning they would get a different mission that they had to complete, like shovel the neighbor's sidewalk or make cookies for, you know, whoever, or sit next to someone at lunch that you don't usually sit next to. And so it was somehow the kids were like, oh, this is awesome. I love this. But then Henry, he's really always been really smart, and he was probably 7 at the time. And he looked at me and he's like, yeah, Mom, but Elf on the Shelf has an origin story. Where's the North Pole Ninjas? Like, what's the deal? And so I looked over at Tyler and I was like, write it right now. You got to write it. We need an origin story for the North Pole Ninjas so that this can keep going.
Look, Brian Singer, get on the case.
Exactly.
And of course, he did. He wrote the story that night, and we typed it out for the kids. And I don't even remember how it ended up getting,
I think,
to Penguin.
Yeah. So we were talking, I think I had just had one of my poetry books out, and then we mentioned it to my agent and we said, hey, we wrote this kids book and we've given it to the kids and our families, and people really are kind of liking this. They think it's a cool thing. And, you know, every day for 24 days, the North Pole Ninja, the ninjas drop off a new mission for the kids, and they're all good things. It's all ways to spread kindness. And instead of having to give the kids a gift every day for 24 days, they do something. And I was like, and a lot of times they do work for you. So, like, right. You know, they're like, put away the laundry.
Take the trash out.
Totally.
Yes, yeah.
And so we told my agent, she's like, that's pretty cool, actually. And she said, well, I mean, we could just talk to people inside Penguin because they already publish your books and just see if there's anyone that would want to hear what you have to say. And so I think she emailed somebody, and then within, I think, 2 days, we heard back from, he's now our dear, dear friend. He's the president of the Penguin Workshop, which is the kids' book division. And his name is Francesco. And he called us and he said, I heard about this. Would you mind hopping on a quick call? And Sarah and I were both just thinking, this is weird. Like, how did we go from this to the president of Penguin Kids real quick? And so we had a 30-minute meeting with him. And literally at the end of the call, he said, I think this is brilliant. Let's do this. We'll figure out the details later, but let's do this. I want to do this. And we did it. And I mean, it even came to the point where there's a little stuffed doll you get with the book, and then
there's a mascot that Sarah wore.
Yeah, they gave it to Sarah.
So fun.
She wore it in the last time they did the real parade of lights here. On the day after Thanksgiving, she got to wear it in the parade.
It was the best day of my life.
It was amazing. And it's so, I mean, happy. The head on it, it's like 4.5 feet across, and she's like 6 feet tall in it. It's amazing.
It's so fun.
But yeah, it actually happened, and it's funny because it's done really, really well, despite the fact that it's only on shelves about 6 weeks a year. That's it. Mm-hmm. And then the whole, we don't know what's going to happen with the Christmas special. It's in some very good hands right now. The company that it's with won an Oscar on their last animated short. And so they're working on it. You just never know. That everyone promises big things and then you just never know. But I don't know. It sounds like there's hope for this, and it just, if more people figure out about it, I think it would be fantastic.
That's really cool.
No, it sounds like a fantastic idea. Having gone through the various stages of little kidness, and you know, I was just reading an article today that, you know, to your point, the tooth fairy inflation.
Oh my gosh.
Is at the point where now, you know, you're getting a Louis Vuitton bag or $100.
Yeah.
That's insane. You know,
it was a quarter when I was a kid.
Yeah, it still was with my kids. Yeah. I mean, maybe a dollar.
Yeah, maybe. If it was a big tooth.
Yeah.
Well, and it just takes one parent, by the way, to jack that up. Parents, I know. Over here on microphone number two. Stop giving your kids $50 bills because then they tell my kid.
Yes.
My kid's
yes.
Like, our tooth fairy sucks.
Yes, you're exactly right.
It does.
It's a problem.
That's ridiculous.
It is something to hear you describe all of these various projects, because it seems they're all kind of tied together whether it's intentional or not, an authenticity in wanting to express something, and with the way you're wired, only having a single one-way lane to express that just not going to work.
Yeah.
I've got this, but also that and this, and they're all happening concurrently while spinning in a dodecahedron
exactly.
at all times,
yes.
you know,
yes,
and
that's
oh,
exactly
look, a
right.
bird.
Yeah.
So it is, I don't know, man.
You've got
Yeah,
it.
You just nailed that.
Well, you really did. Mm-hmm.
We're not that different.
I feel seen.
That's, I'm happy as hell that you guys came in to do this, because this was the conversation I was hoping to have as I went deeper and deeper and deeper. I'm like, man, either these guys are the biggest frauds on the planet, or they're really sweet people. And, you know, and I'm happy for the latter. What else? I know there's an answer.
Yeah.
There's got to be something not so backburnered that you guys are, you know, I mean, you've got animation, you've got books, you've got poetry, you've got your photography, trying to put a cut on the travel. Yeah. What happens if you stay local? How does that manifest? Because obviously there's going to be distractions born of that.
Oh, yeah.
Because you know people here.
Oh,
right,
yeah.
Right. I think that, I mean, we said we didn't want to travel as much, and then we didn't travel as much, and we're like, oh wait,
we need to travel.
We need to travel a little bit. We're hoping to do some retreats, either maybe in Helena or elsewhere, with some of the people that we've taught the courses with. We'd really love to. I mean, in this digital age, it's just so nice to see people in real life. And there's it's just an easier connection that way. And so,
especially after 2020.
Oh God. Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you,
yeah.
Yeah. We didn't.
Right.
No, we couldn't have anything.
Yeah.
Right.
And so we're hoping to do that. We have two more kids' books that are being sent out.
Yeah.
Like pretty much as we speak.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah. We just have to
so,
wait on that. It's always waiting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. It's interesting.
And your signal fire is.
Yeah, like, that's, yeah, there's a lot of, like you said, there's a lot of irons and a lot of fires always. It's always been that way. I think to touch on what you said about the retreats, I think the weirdest thing I've noticed is the more connected everything gets, the more the internet is everywhere. Starlink satellites are making, you know, you could be anywhere in the world and still be connected. The weirdest thing is everybody is way more disconnected. And we've noticed that. I mean, if you go to like a high school basketball game now, you look around, no one's even watching the game. Everyone's sitting on their own little thing. And I get so scared about that kind of stuff. Like the new Apple Vision Pro that's out. It's
just wear it on your face.
God, I'm wondering like in 10 years, are we going to seriously be, you know, waiting for a train or getting in the airport, and everybody's going to have their own headphones, their own headset. No one's going to be speaking. It's going to be like Wall-E already.
Yeah. Black Mirror.
Yeah, yes. Black, it really 100%. Is. Yeah. And right. So I think that's where, like she said, the retreats are something we really want to do, because there is such a need for, especially people, like I said, that might feel out of place or broken or whatever, for them to just see that there's other people that are feeling the same way, but then everyone's okay. And just to be able to be together like that is such a big thing. So that's definitely a big one. And then, yeah, she said, I have a newsletter called Signal Fire that I send out, and it's grown bigger than I thought it would. And it's my favorite thing that I'm doing right now. It's my favorite writing I'm able to do it. And I'm trying to grow that. And yeah, we have two kids' books that are fluttering out and seeing what's going to happen with, and we're trying to book weddings, and it's just
a constant.
It's always
of all that technology that they're working on. I would encourage you two to get into cloning, so you can really, because you need about six or seven of you.
We
of
really
all the things
do.
You're doing well. I mean, you didn't even mention that I think you guys are incredibly good for the education of what autism is, what the spectrum means. We hear those terms and we just don't know. Yeah. What it means. Yeah. And I think that, you know, you being here in this studio has just kind of opened my eyes to a little bit about the stuff in my personal life, about people I deal with and people that I've known. And you being an advocate for people who are on the spectrum, and then you being able to show what you do with it is an amazing team of two people who could also just go out and do that on your own. I mean, that could be your entire thing, and you'd be doing great things. And then you add it to all this other pile of stuff you got. It's just it's a lot, but every bit of it is I can completely understand why it's successful.
Well, thank you.
And I think it's awesome. I mean, that's a lot going on, but man.
On that front, my best friend and I, he lives in Wales. He's autistic and his name is Ash. He and I did a little video Zoom podcast during COVID called Somewhere on the Spectrum. And it was just two different viewpoints of what life on the spectrum is like. And I think we made 13 episodes, and they're all on YouTube. I think like the biggest one has like 900 views. But the sad thing about that is like you just said, that's something that we both feel really strongly about talking about more and doing more. And I'm trying to be a lot more vocal about it. I just get bored when I talk about myself in those ways, unless it's talking about superpowers, then I think it's fun. But
it's really important.
It is. And I think it takes hearing that, I think, sometimes to remind us that, oh, yeah, there is a need for this and we should be better about that. But
because I think as a parent, your biggest like desire for your kids is for them to be loved and to love other people. And so, I don't know, as a teacher of kids with autism, that was always the parent's biggest fear was, well, is my kid ever going to be able to be in a relationship with someone or, you know, see the world or do all these things. And I think that it's really important for parents to be able to see that, yes, that is possible. And if you give them the tools to navigate this world that is crazy and broken, then that is something that can happen. And so, yeah, I do. I agree. I think that it's something that needs to be talked about a lot more, and not just autism, just mental health in general too, that, you know, there are things that we can all do to help people who are, you know, not neurotypical or who are, you know, struggling in some way or another.
Yeah. I'm going to keep that one in my pocket the next time I have an argument with my wife, by the way. Like, it's not my fault. I'm not neurotypical.
Exactly.
To which she'll say, I'm aware. That's the problem.
Oh, yeah. That don't.
I don't ever.
And there's definitely times where I'm like, I don't care. I know it's hard for you, but you're still my husband and we still have to do this.
I don't think I've ever, I will say proudly, I have never once blamed anything
No.
On autism. I definitely think like there's times it explains behavior, but it doesn't excuse the behavior.
Like, oh, you're still being a jerk. We're still
you just took all the air out of my argument.
I know. I'm sorry. Sorry. You can cut this part out. Yeah,
I'll tell you what. You know what's crazy is, and proof to what you guys have going, we're over an hour.
Oh, whoa. My gosh.
Yeah. It goes fast when you guys get here. Yeah. And I promise to keep it there because you're obviously very busy. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please come back.
Oh, we would love to.
We need updates now. I mean, you guys have got enough stuff going on.
Sure.
When the show comes out, when the next children's books come out, we will get all of the links, all the show links to Chasers of the Light, to the website, cool. to the Instagram page, to the YouTube page, all of that stuff, because there's not just one place to find you. Is there a place you'd like people to go specifically? Is there one hub to kind of find some of this?
I mean, our website, Chasers of the Light. Yeah.
Chasersofthelight.com.
There's links to all the things.
Right. Yeah, you can get to the Signal Fire, and you can get to the weddings, and you can get to the books. And
you can just send us an email if you want to yell at us about something.
Whatever.
Or
you
ask a question.
Somebody yells at you, you send them to me. I specialize in the yelling department. I'm going to holler back.
I love it.
And again, both of you, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This was every bit what I had hoped for, and about 1,000 things more.
Definitely.
That means a lot.
So, keep track of them. Go check the show notes. It'll be on all of the platforms. Okay. It's on Spotify and iTunes. It's in all the places. And please rate, review, and subscribe to this. Follow these guys. Keep track of everything. There's something that touched a nerve, I guarantee. If you're still with us at this point in the conversation, you didn't get missed. So please do that, and we will be back next week.